This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is an end to the conflict in Yemen in sight? The United Nations has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Millions face famine and cholera. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. An informal agreement to reduce hostilities between Saudi-led coalition forces and Houthi rebels in and around Yemen's Red Sea port city of Hodeidah has finally taken hold. Analysts hope that the move could be a prelude to long-overdue peace talks in this war-torn country. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other Sunni Muslim countries in the coalition are seeking to oust Houthi rebel forces who drove the government of Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi from power and seized control of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, in 2015. The United States and allies say the Houthis, an indigenous group to Yemen, are backed by Iran, a charge that Tehran denies. But especially since 2015, what was once seen as a largely domestic fight has been transformed into an arena for the regional feud between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman launched the Yemen intervention in 2015, not long after he took over the Saudi Defense Ministry. It was supposed to lead to a quick rout of the Houthi rebels. Instead, it has become a quagmire in which more than 16,000 civilians have been killed or injured, mostly in Saudi airstrikes that hit schools, mosques, markets, weddings, funerals, and in August, a bus full of children. However, the fallout from the recent murder and dismemberment of exiled Saudi citizen and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul has forced the Trump administration to rein in the Saudi regime and its putative leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh vociferously denies that the Crown Prince ordered the murder of Khashoggi, but Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan alleges the order to kill him came from the highest levels of the Saudi government. Heretofore, the United States has provided the kingdom with a blank check in terms of its campaign in Yemen because Washington perceives it to be a vital part of countering the spread of Iranian influence throughout the region. Throughout the conflict, the United States has provided sizable direct support for the coalition, including mid-air refueling, targeting intelligence, and some direct action by U.S. special forces operating along the Saudi-Yemen border. So will the United States go further than ending refueling operations for Saudi planes and halt sales and deliveries of munitions and spare parts, as well as possibly freeze U.S. intelligence and technical support for the Saudi-led coalition? We'll ask our distinguished guests. Ambassador Stephen Sesh is a 35-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service. Among his many senior posts, he served as ambassador to Yemen from 2007 to 2010. Currently, he is executive vice president of the Arab Gulf States Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Daniel Ben-Aim, he's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and that's an independent, nonpartisan policy institute based here in Washington. Previously, Daniel served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. He was also an advisor on Middle East issues to former Vice President Joe Biden. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Great, Carol. Thank you. Thanks. Good to be here.
Ambassador Sesh, let me begin with you. We discussed this conflict back in January, and here we are. Things have gotten worse, not only for the humanitarian situation. It's a terrible tragedy what's going on in Yemen. Give us a sense now where things stand, both on the humanitarian front as well as politically.
Well, I think you started with the epicenter of the conflict on the ground, which is the Red Sea port city of Hodeidah. That's still very much in play. It's a crucial piece of real estate, and whoever controls Hodeidah will get to control the port through which 80% of all the food and humanitarian assistance into Yemen flows. So it's critically important that it not shut down, that those corridors remain open and accessible. Politically, there's very little happening as far as I can see. The UN Special Envoy had scheduled consultations at the end of November in Europe. That seemed to be on track. And then I think the whole business in Hodeidah escalated And it seemed to me it was kind of working at cross purposes. So he's now decided or announced he will try to do something at the end of the year, possibly in Europe as well, a little breathing space to see if we can't resolve something, the kind of thing you described, where maybe now we're trying to de-escalate the conflict in Hodeidah and move the parties away from each other so they can begin to see the way clear to actually enter into, and these are indirect negotiations or consultations. They're not even room-to-room, face-to-face. It is a very low platform the envoy has built for himself to try to get the parties even close to each other in proximity so they can begin to talk about confidence-building measures in Yemen.
Daniel Ben-Naim, please feel free to add or subtract to whatever Ambassador Sesh said and give us a sense of what's really at stake here in Yemen, both for the region and the world.
I think what's at stake at this moment is that after about a year and three quarters in the Trump administration and 3+ years in the Obama administration, when U.S. military support and U.S. In-air refueling for Saudi aircrafts that were bombing Yemen continued fairly uninterrupted, what we've seen is a pretty significant shift in the wake of the international pressure against Saudi Arabia after the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It seems that that crystallized a lot of unease around the way that America was working with Saudi Arabia and the way that Saudi Arabia was prosecuting this war in Yemen. And so you saw Defense Secretary Jim Mattis say, enough of admiring this problem. We've done enough of that. We have about 30 days. You guys need to have a ceasefire in place within the next 30 days. And you saw an end to U.S. in-air refueling of these Saudi jets. Now, the fact is that the Saudis are able to do a lot of their own in-air refueling, so that's in some ways largely symbolic. But this is a case where the symbolism really counts. Saudi Arabia is trying to open itself up to international investment, to a totally different relationship with the outside world than it's had in the past. That is a defining project for this crown prince. And one of the most important conduits for the crown prince to do that is his relationship with the United States and with the Trump administration in particular, which has put so much stock in him. The U.S. president decided to make his very first international visit, breaking with a lot of convention, to Riyadh. So I think what you're seeing here is a bet that both sides have taken on each other that has reached a very difficult juncture because of the Khashoggi murder and because of the ongoing violence in Yemen. And the United States seems to be making a bet, perhaps belatedly, that through the pressure that they're now exerting, they can change the equation and change the dynamic such that the sides are pushed toward diplomacy. Now, that's a tall order, but I think that's what they're trying to do, and it's a notable shift.
Do you see that notable shift as a result of this Khashoggi murder and how that has affected the U.S.-Saudi relationship, Ambassador Sesh?
There's no doubt that there's been a Khashoggi effect, if you will, on the behavior and the judgments and the calculus of a lot of international parties. Daniel's more generous than I would be about the position of the United States and how much pressure we're willing to apply. Sure, I've seen the statements, as you all did, Jim Mattis, Mike Pompeo. I said at the time, if Mr. Pompeo were as serious about getting something done as he seemed to be in the statements, he would get on his airplane and fly immediately to Riyadh or Abu Dhabi or Muscat or anywhere and really tell the parties, let's get something done here. He didn't do that. So I think, to my judgment, and maybe I'm being less generous than I should be, but I see this as a way for the United States to get out of the way of this wave of indignation that's swamping over Saudi Arabia. And we are pretty much guilt by association is our issue right now because of the refueling, logistical support. And I think we're going to step aside, distance ourselves a little bit, and hope that this will get out of the way, too, and we can go back to business as usual.
Now, one additional element to mention here in this complicated equation, which is complicated enough on the Yemeni side, is the addition of a Democratic House of Representatives, which I think you could well see begin passing legislation come January to significantly restrict the conduct of this war or to restrict weapon sales to the Gulf. And I think the Trump administration wants to get ahead of that. And if they're nimble about it, they can use that as leverage if they want to end this war. But the question that the ambassador rightly raised is, how much are they willing to invest in really seeing a change in behavior? And how much is this a public relations exercise? And we'll have to see.
Exactly. That's a really good point. So back to any kind of U.S. influence on Saudi Arabia, and back to this fundamental question, which drove the Saudis to launch this offensive back in March 2015, which is to counter Iranian influence. Talk about, Ambassador Sesh, any relationship between the Houthis and Iran at that time, and how is it today?
Well, the Houthis have had long-standing relationships with the Iranians. That goes way back to 1979 with the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And from then on, you know, the Iranians have looked around the region for any aggrieved Shia population they can create relationships with. And that's true in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in Iraq, and in Yemen. And so, you know, the Houthis are part of the Shia minority in Yemen, and they were always having exchanges, trips back and forth, educational opportunities. It was never really politicized, and it was never merely militarized until probably in any material way until after 2015, when the Saudis entered with their coalition. For the Iranians, that was an invitation to do the same thing, and they've slowly ratcheted up their support to the Houthis until now. I think we've seen enough evidence to convince me, certainly, that they provide missile component parts that have helped the Houthis extend the range of missiles that they've been able to pick up out of the arsenals of the Yemeni military in the course of the war. So now these 300-mile range Scuds can now go 500 miles, and that's much deeper into Saudi territory than ever possible. And so that becomes a real threat to Saudi Arabia, and that makes them really unnerved, and it should be.
Sure, it makes them unnerved, and it's a threat. And the United States, by virtue of its opposition to Iran's hegemony or rising hegemony in the region, Daniel Ben-Naim, they see the Saudi coalition as a true ally. But we're 3 years or more on into this horrific conflict. Do we have anything to show for this military offensive? And do we see a diminishment of Iranian influence or perhaps the opposite?
No, you really see the opposite. And I think both sides in this Saudi-Iran conflict have a habit of looking at the other side and assuming that anybody who is different may be in league with their enemy. And I think that the fact is that for the Houthis, this wasn't about Iran and isn't about Iran. And as the ambassador was saying earlier, if Iran disappeared tomorrow, the Houthis would keep on fighting for what they've won. Now, the fact is, and it appears to be a fact increasingly, that the Iranians have proliferated some fairly dangerous technology into the hands of the Houthis. There are reports that they gave them anti-ship missiles, which can endanger maritime traffic through the Bab al-Mandab, which is a very important maritime commercial pathway as well, and the missiles that the ambassador described. And you take all that together, and Iran has acted very irresponsibly. But the reason that they've done it is not simply because they want to create a Hezbollah-style proxy in the Houthis, which the Houthis, by the way, get a vote in, and they may well not want to be a wholly owned subsidiary of Iran. The reason that Iran wants to do this is because they've successfully tied down Saudi Arabia, and they're near abroad in Yemen. And I think it's no accident that Iran has slowly calibrated the proliferation of these weapons and the release of military support to Yemen, not merely to go all in, as we've seen them do in a place like Syria, but just enough to keep the fighting going. And it's a terribly cynical approach. But I think they have correctly bet on the fact that the Saudis can't seem to stop what they view as an anti-Iran pushback, even when the result of that pushback is making the Houthis more dependent on Iran, more ideologically aligned on Iran, closer tied to Hezbollah and other Iranian-aligned actors who have come there to help them defend themselves in a war. So I think it's had nearly exactly the opposite of its intended outcome of preventing Iran from entrenching itself in northern Yemen.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Stephen Sesh. He's former ambassador to Yemen, currently executive vice president of the Arab Gulf States Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington, and Daniel Ben-Naim, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington, and we're talking about the political and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website and for free download on iTunes. You can find the download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Zabi Hulalami from Kabul, Afghanistan. And again, if you want to hear your name on the air, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Ambassador Sesh. To get a sense of the humanitarian conditions on the ground, I mean, we're talking about a population suffering from famine, cholera. How are they coping, and, you know, what is being done to mitigate this humanitarian catastrophe.
I think we've seen recently, Carol, finally some images that are coming out of Yemen that demonstrate the depth of suffering and the appalling characteristics of this famine and just how badly the situation has deteriorated in recent months and years. And that is largely a result of the ongoing air war and the missteps and the strikes that have hit civilian populations. The Houthis are responsible as well for their share of the suffering. There are humanitarian organizations, the United Nations and others on the ground. There are private INGOs on the ground, international organizations that are trying to move assistance around the country, and they're fairly successful given the limitations of a war zone. And also there's a terrible war economy, so that every piece of assistance that goes onto a highway probably gets stopped 6 or 7 or 8 times and taxed at checkpoints run by everyone and their brother. They're all profiteering from this war. So it has just brought out the worst instincts of everyone pretty much on the ground. And so people are trying to cope, but hospitals have been taken offline, water systems have been struck, electricity grids are down. So the infrastructure that would support the kind of humanitarian assistance we're looking at really has been badly, badly crippled in the process, and people just can't get the help they need.
So, Daniel, do you have anything to add or subtract to that terrible picture?
No, I think that's exactly right. Yemen was on a knife's edge. Even before this conflict, people were warning that its capital city might run out of water. It faces severe ecological, famine-related, and health challenges that predate this conflict. And I wanted to just again underscore the fact that this humanitarian problem, the epicenter, ground zero for it, really is this port city of Hodeida, which 70 to 80% of the supplies coming into Yemen arrive through. And the idea of that city being blocked by a battle, an intensified battle in terms of that port, is catastrophic to even contemplate. And the fact is that in addition to the coalition, the Houthis do deserve their share of the blame for that situation, because by some estimates, they've put as many as 1 million mines in the area around Hodeida. And that, too, will make the distribution of humanitarian goods much harder. So really, the question of whether there is an active ongoing battle of Hodeida that blocks goods through that port is really one of the major determinants of where this humanitarian crisis goes.
Well, back to you, Ambassador Sesh. Having been a former ambassador to Yemen, if you were in a position to advise the parties, the United States in particular, what would you recommend at this point for the United States to do? How can it use its leverage? And do you see any prospects for upcoming peace negotiations by UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths?
I try to be optimistic, Carol. It's difficult in this circumstance to be too optimistic, but I do think that there is a bit of momentum. I think Daniel's described some of it earlier. So I'm not going to dismiss the fact that the voice of the United States does carry weight. Our words do matter, and it has created a certain amount of momentum that other countries are picking up on. I hope, again, we can translate those pious pronouncements into real actual behavior and pressure. And I do think if we can understand what Martin Griffiths has in mind, what the confidence-building measures are likely to look like, and go to Saudi Arabia and say, okay, here's the choices you're going to have to start to make. What can we do as your friend and partner to make it easier for you to get to yes on these moments? What can we do to help you make the decisions that are difficult? We understand that. Can we help you with some defensive measures that'll help you feel that your territory is secure and not vulnerable to Houthi missile strikes? Can we do things in terms of allowing prisoners to be exchanged so you're not going to feel vulnerable to those elements as they are released from prison? But we need to help push them, and we need to help encourage them and get them to a position where they can say, yes, we can agree to some of these things. Now, the Houthis are the big question mark for me. I don't know who talks to the Houthis effectively. Iran might have an opportunity. They've said they're willing to try, but they say at the same time, we don't control them. Now, of course, they've never admitted any control, and I don't think they have control. I think Daniel's right. Maybe the Russians can talk to them a little bit. I don't know. We need to find out who can get into their ear and into their head a little bit and say, you guys have to stand down at the same time.
How do you see that, Daniel?
You know, that's exactly right. There's a big question mark around the Houthis' willingness to participate in a peace process. When they held meetings in September, they didn't show up. They gained a great deal very quickly in the course of these last couple of years, and so they may feel like they have nothing to lose by continuing to hang on to what they have. And part of what happens here, unfortunately, is that when the United States puts pressure on one side of this conflict, as I very much believe we should, and we're late to doing, the other side may feel that pressure is eased off them. The Houthis may feel that, why would we negotiate now when America is pressuring the UAE and Saudi? So we have to find a way to anticipate that, to get other countries to put countervailing pressure on the Houthis, as the ambassador suggested, but also to think ahead to what happens if diplomacy fails, because it would be a very bad outcome if this sort of little surge of pressure, which I agree with the ambassador may not amount to much, but it has already led to at least a temporary halt in bombing. If that little surge isn't met by a response from the Houthis, and then the Saudis and the Emiratis say, see, we tried, and now we're forced to go for broke and continue aggressively bombing Hodeidah, that would be a bad outcome indeed. So we have to be talking about plans B, C, and D here. And I guess my hope is that plan B is, even if the Houthis aren't ready to talk, we go to some kind of a freeze-for-freeze model here, where aerial strikes stop, the missile strikes stop, and we get some kind of a humanitarian pause and seek to put in place some of those confidence-building measures. And even if the Houthis aren't quite ready, the Saudis try to implement that kind of a unilateral ceasefire. Because I think this war is going nowhere good, and America certainly has no interest in seeing it relapse into a renewed period of violence, as may well happen.
Ambassador Sesh, what more do you think the United States can do besides what it has already pledged to do, which is to stop the refueling for Saudi planes and continue to pressure Saudi Arabia to refrain from these attacks and to certainly not attack the port, Hodeidah? You know, what about some more radical solutions, halt deliveries of arms? President Trump always talks about that's probably a red line. I don't know. I mean, what else can the United States do to pressure at least the Saudi coalition?
I don't expect to see the executive branch, the White House or the State Department, move vigorously to shut off the flow of weapons. You know, the argument has been, and it's a difficult one to make and hard to hear, that if we didn't provide the Saudi coalition with our smart weapons, then someone's going to sell them dumb bombs and you're going to have more civilian casualties. That's a calculation that's, as I say, complicated and difficult to imagine. But I do think that, as Daniel said earlier, our Congress is going to have a say in this now. And I think the Democratic-controlled House is going to schedule hearings and they're going to require testimony. And they're going to start to look very carefully in how can we ratchet this up. And there's even a possibility that the Senate will be in a lame duck session, move one more time on this joint resolution, which calls for the War Powers Act to be invoked in Yemen because of our support for the Saudi coalition with the Houthis, who don't pose a threat to the United States. So they don't come under the AUMF of 2001 that allows us to go in there and fight al-Qaeda in Yemen because they are a terrorist threat to the country. So I think we're going to begin to see the Senate involve itself in ways that is going to start to drive Washington in directions that hasn't been moving in recent months.
And this is a bipartisan issue. You have Senator Bernie Sanders, who is probably the leftmost out of 100 U.S. senators. And you had Senator Mike Lee in Utah, who's one of the rightmost and most libertarian in the entire body of 100 senators, co-sponsoring legislation on this front. So while the Democrats' control of Congress may create additional pressure, this really is a bipartisan issue.
You mentioned al-Qaeda. To the extent the Houthis pose a threat, if they're seen as proxies for Iran or being supported by Iran, what has happened to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which was once seen as the biggest threat out of Yemen, Ambassador Sesh?
And it probably still is the biggest threat out of Yemen, Carol. I think that for years, al-Qaeda basically was allowed to wander around and do what it wanted to do. It controlled Mukalla, the port city of Mukalla in Hadramaut on the Gulf of Aden for over a year because the coalition was so busy fighting the Houthis, it didn't have time or opportunity or interest in pursuing al-Qaeda. That wasn't until the UAE sent its special forces into Mukalla in 2015. They put them on their heels. They've been going after them. The UAE has been developing its own indigenous forces as a counterterrorism. And so I think this has been a pretty successful, if small, low-key operation, but al-Qaeda has not gone away.
Daniel Ben-Naim on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We've been talking about Houthis and this horrible conflict, but where do they stand and how much of a threat do they still pose?
Well, I think there's still a significant threat, even though we have degraded some of the leadership of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Exactly as the ambassador said, it was very troubling to see them gain ground at the beginning of this conflict. And even now, there are reports that some al-Qaeda groups have made tactical truces with the other forces fighting the Houthis and either been bought off or in some cases joined on the same side of the battle. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly been reported in the media that that's the case. And if it is true, it's very troubling, and I hope that it's something that a new Congress will look into also. I wouldn't be too overly optimistic about what happens in this next round of peace talks, but I do think that any day when we can stop bombs from falling from outside Yemen is a good day, and we should try to extend that for as long as possible. Yemen has a lot of its own internal conflicts that will grind on even after this international coalition and the Houthi conflict is over. But anything we can do to reduce suffering and prevent a humanitarian crisis around Hodeidah is very welcome and more than worth the effort.
Well, on that relatively optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Stephen Sesh, who's former ambassador to Yemen, and Daniel Ben-Aim, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Gentlemen, thanks so much for shedding light on this conflict in Yemen. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.